So would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Elisaveta.
Ah, you see, I couldn't have said that as well as you did. For starters.
If I said it the way, like really in Russian, I would say Elisaveta. So yeah. there's a yeah in the beginning, but in the States and in English normally I just say Elisaveta.
There's New York, there's Russia, there's LA. There's quite a mix there. And then somewhere in the middle of this is an Italian monastery. Can you fill in some interesting blanks there? Because that's quite a mix. That's not your average mix, is it?
No, also somewhere in the middle there was Switzerland, Prague. So there's definitely not an average mix. I was born in New York because my parents were interpreters for the UN. And then when I was right after I was born, a few months later, they were restationed back to Moscow. So obviously I was a baby, so I went with them.
Lollapalooza, I love your scrapbook, and I love the way that you kind of portray the things that you've been through so far. But so how does, with what you are portrayed as doing, how did it feel to be in amongst all these bands at Lollapalooza?
You know, I do what I do, and then I think if you do any kind of music and you do it well, which I hope I do at this point, you can find, I mean, there's no, music can coexist in you know, on the same stage. I think you can have a number of different people with different influences, as long as I think the authenticity is there and the quality, you know, I think that it doesn't have to be that strange. You know, you could put an opera singer next to a rock band, next to a, I don't know, a folk group, and I think it could be rather fun, actually.
Well, and many a rock band has had an operatic singer. We could go on. We could go on for years about that. You're having dinner with somebody, and somebody says to you, "So, what kind of music do you make?" Right? So over dinner.
That is the $1,000 question. So that is one of the reasons why I came up with the whole term. I call myself an alchemist, you know, a musical alchemist. And that would be my answer, you know, because I take...
And when they go, duh, huh, what's that mean? How do you dumb it down?
Well, then we
and
can...
Do you care about dumbing it down?
Well, if they don't know what alchemy is, you know, then I'm very happy to explain to them. We start talking about the Middle Ages and, you know, magic and all sorts of interesting, fun things. But
what if they don't know anything about the 19th century? And what if they're just not hip enough to know the 21st century?
Well, it's basically, then I say it's basically magic. You know, you take in different genres and elements, you throw them in the same pot, and out comes my music. And then I just say, you just have to hear it.
And then do you
stand up and sing very loudly at dinner? Autotune is a funny thing. First of all, I think you can't hear it. Just like, you know how they say these days, I mean, first of all, now we're in the world of digital recording, but I've also played a little bit with recording on tape. And in an ideal world, you know, soon enough I'll be able to afford to have a little studio or have a friend, you know, with a tape machine somewhere and afford tape. Because I think these are all the things that you can't necessarily hear, but you can feel them. So just like, for example, I think that's the main difference between analog recording and digital recording. One is, for an analog recording, you have to produce a performance, which means that you have to do it from the beginning to the end without any mistakes. And you have to think forward, and you have to be in the moment, and you basically have to be right there, you know, because there's no go over, really. And secondly, with analog is you can't necessarily distinguish it from the digital recording by listening to it so much. It's you feel it, you know. And same thing, I think, with auto-tune. You hear somebody singing, and they sound great. Everything's great. Everything's fantastic. But there's an element of humanity, I think, to singing without auto-tune, that to recording without auto-tune, that you can feel with your body, and that's something, I think, that happens on a subconscious level. That's just my personal opinion.
Do you consider it a pop music album?
You know, I do. To me, pop means idealistically sort of the best of all worlds. You know, it means something that's really current. But to me, it doesn't mean that it doesn't... To me, pop just means that it's something that can be or is popular. I also think that the world is pretty unpredictable and anything can become popular at any given moment, you know, so why not, you know?
It's just... Who would have thought Queen, you know, you listen to Bohemian Rhapsody and who would think that would be a gigantic song?
Right. Yeah, I think...
As an example.
Well, that's a perfect example. I think the most unlikely... That's the thing. I think the things that oftentimes everybody thinks are the sure thing, you know, they... Just by being so obvious, they end up not being that, you know. I think it's almost always the dark horse or the something that everybody thought, oh, that's kind of weird, but there's something interesting about it.
Exactly.
And that song was certainly probably written without, you know, the Queen. I don't know its history, but I'm sure that Bohemian Rhapsody wasn't written. It's like, oh man, let's write a single.
Not a 6 minute. No, not, not, no. I mean, Hey Jude got away with it, but there are not a lot of 6 minute singles that suddenly get played on top 40 radio, you know, and become iconic like that. So now you get to Greg Wells. Now tell me order of appearance, because how did you come upon signing to a big label for starters?
Well, I had a really good friend. I still have my friend. Now he actually works at EMI, but at the time he was director of programming at iTunes, Alex Luke. And Alex heard one of my songs online, and we started a dialogue, and then we became friends, and we heard the rest of my songs, and one thing led to another, and he just kind of became my, I don't know, fairy godfather. So he started spreading my music around, and he played a couple of my songs for Monty Lipman, who's head of Universal Republic. So I flew to play for them in New York to perform, and so I performed for him at the, you know, at the little performance space, which was right next to his office. And then he offered me a deal there, and I thought about it, and I said, okay.
You have a lot of luxuries you wouldn't have if you signed with a smaller indie label, right?
It's a risk, but I think that, you know, at the time, what I was looking for in general, you know, felt like it was present there. There was a certain energy. I think that, first of all, Universal Republic is part of Universal. You know, it's a big label, but then it's not really a big label. So I was looking for a certain energy and for a certain sense of community. And I had performed, I had showcased for a few other labels, and so this wasn't my first. And it felt different to me at the time. So it felt intuitively right. I could prove myself wrong, but, you know, I'm happy where I'm at. And I think it's everything is a gamble, you know.
Now, I listened to, you know, a few of the album tracks online, and then I also watched live performance. So a producer like Greg Wells, when you are, now, did that come through the label? Were you given choices of producers? How did that all happen?
That's actually an interesting story. I had met with a few different producers, and I yet wanted to meet a few more, you know. But... it was actually the label. It was Tom Mackay, who was my A&R, who suggested Greg. And when I looked at his resume, I actually, at first I was like, oh, well, I don't know. It seems like he's been doing mostly like really pop records recently, and I don't know if that's what I'm going for. You know, maybe that's not. But okay, you know, I'll meet with him. And I met him. And he was really tired, and he was drinking coffee, you know, and I was drinking coffee. And I played him some of his songs in the studio, some of my songs, I'm sorry, in his studio. And there was this connection, you know. We started talking about Stravinsky. He actually spoke about the book that I know that is one of his favorite books, and Stravinsky is one of his favorite composers. I found out more about his background. He has a classical background as well. He's a fantastic pianist. I mean, he's a far better pianist than I am. And he's also a fantastic drummer and guitar player and all these different things. And, you know, so we had this moment. And then just a few days later, Tom calls me and says, well, what did you think about Greg? Because he needs to pencil you in, or, you know, do you want to meet other people? Because otherwise, you know, he may not be available, la, la, la. So at that moment, I was a little irritated because I was like, well, I was going to say no, you know. But then I thought about it, and once again, intuitively, this was a very intuitive choice. I can be a very rational person, you know, and think things through a lot and kind of weigh them over and over. But in that moment, I just kind of made a spur-of-the-moment decision. It felt right, so I said yes. And I went in the studio, and it was the right decision.
And I've talked to a ton of artists about the producer-artist relationship. So when you had your vision, and then you get in with him, and he obviously had a vision too, how did what I've heard so far come to be?
Actually, it was an interesting thing. I think that Greg is an amazing producer, and I'm not saying that just because, you know, I want to be nice and him hearing this interview call me and say, oh, thanks for saying this. But I'm just saying that because it's true. There are producers who, I think there's two kinds of producers. There's a producer type who have their own specific sound. And everybody goes to them because, you know, it's almost like a signature thing. You know, it's like you put something in that box, you take it out, and you know that it is going to be like this. And then there's the type of the producer, which I think is a lot more rare. And that is the person who will bring out in the artist what it is that needs to be brought out in order for it to be authentic. And Greg is that kind of guy, you know. And in the process, when I went in, I was intimidated. First of all, I did not have a specific vision. A week passed, and we recorded some demos. And I was just kind of waiting, and we were recording, and it was okay, but it wasn't quite clicking just yet. So he sat me down at the end of the first week, and he said, okay, listen, my best records, he said, I've done, were when the artist went beyond the requirement in giving me input. Because you have to be... You just have to, I forget what he said, you just have to like vomit all your, like what you think, what you want, what maybe you want, what you definitely don't want, what you could possibly, it's like, don't hold anything back, because I know I can feel you holding back, because I need you to make this record with me. And when he said that, I had this distinct moment when I felt like I was having a split personality moment, because there was one part of me that went, yes, fantastic, this is exactly what I need. This is great. And then there was the other part of me that went, oh, because that was the part that had expected me, you know, to walk into the studio with a big name producer and walk out, you know, a couple of months later with this perfect record with a bow on top of it without really, you know, doing much except for singing and, you know, playing my songs. And
you're so, like, uh-oh, I have to do work now.
Yeah, well, I was prepared to work, but... You know, it was great. It was, and then after that, I consistently participated more and more and more and more and more and more. And you know, I started. I discovered that I had a talent for hearing certain things and also doing vocal arrangements. And so all the vocal arrangement that I did on the record were actually mine. I did them in the closet at my house.
Do you have you kind of visualized how big you want to be? Because I know that, you know, the Adeles of the world, if you ask them what I'm asking you at this moment in time, they would have absolutely no vision whatsoever that next thing you know, these things, and you talk about the fairy tale, this thing could happen. So what do you really want? Do you want to be huge? Do you want to...
First, I think it would be the number two. Is in the sense that I do want to make a living and be free, you know, to move about and say, for example, help my mom, you know, who's in Russia, and I'll bring her here, or, you know, buy a house, you know, those basic things. And then I think I want to be as good as I can be at what it is that I do, you know. Because at the end of the day, I think that is what really drives me. It's not really the whole star thing. It's like, oh, I want to be bigger than, you know, insert blank. It's more like, how far can I take this in the quality of what it is that I do? Because I always know. I always know how well I'm doing. You know, if I've done a concert, I always know how well, you know, I don't need to ask anyone, you know. And I also know when I record something, I always know how good it is or how I could do a little better. So it's really kind of between me and me. And I want to be as good as I can be.
I do a thing called a musical sandwich. And it's two of your songs as the bread. And then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.